What I wanted to talk about today is the Uganda scheme. What is the Uganda scheme? We're going to explain. If you look at the source sheet, on the first source here is this document. It's not actually in German. For some reason, the version I found online is from a German textbook or something, and it has a line of German at the top. But really, it's very much in English, as you'll see. And what this is the proclamation of the British government to commit to finding a Jewish territory, a Jewish homeland for the Jews, not actually in Uganda. The first thing to know, if you want to be a buff about this in history, is that it's called the Uganda Scheme or the Uganda Plan. Has anyone heard about this before, the Uganda Scheme, right? So it's not, wasn't actually in Uganda. It was really an area in what is today Kenya, but what was called the British East African Protectorate. And so the British government made this commitment to try and find an area for the Jews there. I want to talk a little bit about the background of this document. How did this come to be, that this declaration or this promise was made? And then I want to talk a little bit about the results of that. How are we supposed to look at that from a lens of Zionism, as Jews, as religious Zionists? And that'll lead to a little bit of discussion about what exactly is it that makes Israel, the country, the place, so special? Why do we treat it in a different way than anywhere else? So just a few minutes of background on this document on the Uganda Plan. The Zionist movement began 1896, 1897. Herzl started this movement, Theodor Herzl, to find a homeland for the Jews. And it's important to remember that basically it was a response in Herzl's mind to anti-Semitism that he saw rampant in Europe. He saw it in Eastern Europe. There it was for sure. But even in Western Europe, you know, the story is that he writes about it, that he was covering as a journalist the Dreyfus trial in France, and there was a captain in the French army who was basically, you know, put in and out of jail for years, a long time. Eventually he was acquitted, but it was a very, at its base, anti-Semitic kind of trial. And so Herzl decided, it's enough is enough, we have to create a homeland for the Jews so that they can have somewhere to escape from this kind of persecution. So they start the Zionist movement, 1897, there's a conference, and they're trying to get going, and basically not a lot is happening. They're trying to meet the original plan, the original statement of the Zionist movement was to create for the Jewish people, a home in Palestine secured by public law. The goal was to make a country in Eretz Yisrael. That's what they wanted to do. But so they're trying to do this, and not much is really happening. They're meeting with at the time, Palestine was under the control of the Turkish Ottoman Empire, and they're meeting with the Sultan. The Sultan's not really interested. They're meeting with the Russians. I mean, the Russians have good influence there. Maybe they'll manage to influence the Turks. Nothing's happening. Not a lot is happening. In the meantime, anti-Semitism is still very much on the rise in Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe. And so they decide at a certain point, 1902, 1900, something like that, 1901 rather, Herzl decides, okay, we have to start making an alternative plan. If this is not going to work, if we see that getting into Palestine is not going to happen so quickly, then maybe we can try and think about finding somewhere else to go, at least temporarily, so that we can just say we can take these Jews that are being persecuted and just get them out of harm's way and put them somewhere. So he starts to have different kinds of meetings, different kinds of discussions with different leaders, one among them the British government, to perhaps find some place under British rule where, you know, Jews can live. The British did not control Palestine at that time, but they were very welcome or open to trying to find a place for the Jews to live. So he starts to have these negotiations, and that's a little bit of the background. Eventually, in 1903, the British Foreign Office, the Secretary of Colonial Affairs, I don't exactly remember what his precise title was, decides he's traveling to the East Africa Protectorate, and he's on there, he's on the train, and he has an epiphany. This area, you know, that he sees from the train, it was the Uganda Railroad, which is why it became known as the Uganda Plan, possibly. But he's traveling through Kenya, and he sees it's a nice area, it's temperate, it's not too cold, it's not too hot, it's pretty big. Let's give it to the Jews. There's nobody living here. Might as well. It's in East Africa. So he gets back to London, and he says, you know what? Maybe we can suggest this area for the Jews, East Africa. It's pretty far from Israel. So I mean, not as far as Canada is, I guess, but it's pretty far from Israel. He makes this suggestion to Herzl, and Herzl's immediate idea, response still at that time was, we're not going to take this. He writes in his diary, our base must be in or near Palestine. They were considering other areas, maybe a bit of Egypt, maybe something else, or maybe some areas in Syria. We're certainly not going to take this random chunk of land in Africa. Later on, we could also settle Uganda, because we've got lots of people, but certainly we're not going to start our country somewhere in Uganda. But then, what happened, what it seems to have pushed pushed him to sort of try and make this suggestion, was a series of pogroms, and most specifically amongst them, the Kishinev pogrom. The Kishinev pogrom in 1903 was a terrible pogrom, and it wasn't bad in terms of it was bad. There were 49 people killed over a number of days. The bad part about it wasn't the numbers. The bad part about it was that it basically happened, you know, with the blessing of the government. It was led by priests. And I didn't see this confirmed, but I heard a couple people describe it, that the bishop gave a bracha to anyone who would be involved in the proceedings. What certainly is true is that the police and the military was under Russian control, didn't do anything, and they allowed this to happen, to go on for few days before they stepped in to stop the riots, and many people died. Other terrible things happened, which we don't need to go into. And so, you know, this was a terrible event, which made Jews realize, or made Herzl realize, that, you know, if we don't do something very quickly, people's lives are really in danger all the time, because, you know, this could happen at any time. You can put pressure. The Americans tried to put pressure on the Russians. Other people tried to put pressure on the Russians, and nothing happened. The official Russian response was, this was not an anti-Jewish attack, it was an anti-moneylender attack. Tell me if you've heard that one before. So it was an anti-moneylender attack. What happened? The Jews were moneylenders, and all they kept putting interest on the peasants until they broke and they had nothing left. And of course they're going to have a pogrom. It's not an anti-Jewish thing. We love Jews in Russia, but, you know, we don't like Jewish money lenders. So, yeah, sure.
Jews were leaving Eastern Europe from the late 19th century onwards to go to Palestine, like not in huge numbers, but they were. Was there like a quota on that? Is that why Herzl felt that he actually needed like a Jewish country?
So I'm not sure if there was a quota. Clearly it was not something which was easy to do en masse. I don't know exactly what the procedure was like to get into Palestine at the time. But it could be there was a quota. Certainly there was a quota later, I know that, under British rule. But I don't know about, not sure. But clearly it was not something where everyone could just pick up and go, because they would have done that otherwise.
You had to get permission.
From the
Ottoman Empire.
Okay.
You couldn't buy land without their permission, and they rarely granted that. I mean, I think there were times when different rabbis tried to establish, you know, an area, and the Hurban Shul, they tried.
Right.
One year, I forget what year that was, where they did actually get permission to rebuild it, but then they didn't have the money, and then they owed money, so then they took it away from them.
Right.
The Hurban was the only thing that anyone was told. But most people who came to Israel at the time, I think the Beguim and all the other things, they came as not legal immigrants. They came as tourists, and they came to
And then they stayed there. Okay, so that's part of the answer. Certainly buying land, that I was aware of, but I'm not sure about the quotas. Okay, so this is what happened, and so the result was that we had this promise or this declaration from the British government, which we have here. We don't have to read the whole thing, but it's the Secretary for Colonial Affairs, I believe, Chamberlain, who said that that his lordship has... Okay, here, in the third paragraph. I'm now directed by his lordship to say that he has studied the question with the interest which his majesty's government must always take in any well-considered scheme for the amelioration of the position of the Jewish race. The time at his disposal has been too short to enable him to go fully into the details of the plan or to discuss it with his majesty's commissioner for the East Africa Protectorate, and he regrets he is therefore unable to pronounce any definite opinion on the matter. He understands that the trust... desire to send some gentlemen to East Africa Protectorate who may ascertain personally whether there are any vacant land suitable for the purpose in question, and if this is so, he will be happy to give them every facility to enable them to discuss with His Majesty's Commissioner the possibility of meeting the view which may be expressed at the forthcoming Zionist Congress in regard to the conditions upon which a settlement might be possible. If a site can be found which the Trust and His Majesty's Commissioner considers suitable and which commends itself to His Majesty's government, Lord Lansdowne will be prepared to entertain favorably proposals for the establishment of a Jewish colony or settlement on conditions which will enable the members to observe their national customs. And they'd be willing to spend a little bit of money on it, not so much, but this is what we have. So this is given over, and proposals like this, this one's dated from August already, but proposals like this are presented to Herzl, and he finally decides at the Zionist Congress in 1903 that he's going to suggest this, and it was the sixth one already, that he's going to suggest it, he's going to put it out as a proposal, let's see if we can maybe save Jewish lives by taking up the British and making a state in Kenya, or whatever, Uganda. So he proposes it, and so that's the question that we have to ask now. He comes and he says, I think we should do this. This is what we should do. So what do you think? What is the reaction? You have the Zionist movement. Their plan was to create a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. Everybody knows what's happening to the Jews in Eastern Europe. It's not safe. There are people being killed. They can be killed at any time. And we have this opportunity from the British government to establish a country in East Africa where we can start to get Jews and we can save them. We can put them there right away. And even if it's only temporary, eventually we'll get to Eretz Yisrael. So what do you think? I'm opening up the floor. What do you think? What would you vote? How would you look at this? First, we'll look at it from just a plain Zionist perspective. Then we'll look at it from a religious Zionist perspective also. So, thoughts?
I would take it.
You would take it?
Temporary to save lives.
Okay. Okay, so we have one yes. We would take it to, on the assumption that we're saving lives. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Anyone opposed? You're opposed? No? Why not? It's okay.
Because it's, Palestine is Israel. It has the Kedusha, it has the history and everything. Right? You can't just,
She's a religious Zionist.
Okay. Okay.
Because no matter where they would put us, right, assuming it was Uganda or Kenya, in the end, they would say, this is not your land anyway.
Right.
And they won't have any claim to it. Like from our past, like we did with Eretz Israel. Eretz Israel was given to us by Hashem, and for many years, we retained it, and then we were expelled, okay? But that doesn't mean it doesn't belong to us. So I think the reason was that if you go, let's say even in Canada, mm-hmm. one day a government will come and say, well, you know what, we don't want you here either. It's not your land, whatever. It could happen. It happened in Germany. It happened all over here.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, the reason why that they didn't expect
Okay. Okay, good.
Once we take Uganda, it's settled. We got our place. The problem is not on the world scene anymore, and they don't have to worry about us.
Yeah.
So it's done. We have no claim to Palestine. We've got a spot. Shut up.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what's Zionism without Zion?
Exactly.
I mean, it just annuls the whole idea.
Okay. Yep.
Years ago, when we used to go to the Catskills, there was one gentleman at our table. He said to my husband, he says, I'm an American first and I'm a Jew second. Mm-hmm. So my husband really told them the history about our people in a short way. And he says, people will always remind you who you are. It happened in Spain. It happened in other countries. You're always going to be a Jew first, and whoever else you are, you could be excluded.
Okay. Okay, so we got a little bit of the sort of range of views that actually happened at the Zionist Congress. Some people said, and this was why we see, I didn't really realize this until I researched it now, but Herzl was very hesitant about presenting this option in the first place, because after all, it's Israel, that's the goal. The goal is to establish a country in Israel. That was really what we wanted. On the other hand, people are dying. And so if you were going to say, well, but we're going to hold out for Israel, who knows when it's going to happen, right? They've been working on it for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. They got basically nowhere with anyone. We don't know when Israel's going to happen. It's going to happen, but sometime. In the meantime, pogrom can happen any day. So you have to worry about saving people's lives. And amongst, we'll start with the secular Zionists, there was this split. So there were sort of some of the Western European Zionists, Herzl among them, were very interested in just creating a space where Jews can be safe. That's what they wanted. Among the Eastern European Zionists, interestingly, Chaim Weizmann, I had an argument about this with his family, but whatever. But among the Eastern Europeans, including the Jews from Kishinev, the delegates from Kishinev, they said, no way, we don't want this country for a bunch of reasons. Either because, as we mentioned, once you use up all your capital, your money and your political capital establishing this country, they're not going to let you, you're not going to have any steam left to get into Israel. Or because who knows what's going to happen, they're going to kick you out the next day. So this is a debate which raged there. The vote in the end of the day came out slightly in favor of Herzl. The other problem that was in the background here was that this issue threatened to sort of split apart the whole party. The whole movement was going to just dissolve over this debate. So many people abstained out of respect for Herzl or desire for the movement to continue, and it ended up coming out slightly in favor of Herzl. In the end, the Uganda scheme dissolved. Herzl died not long after that Congress, and they did actually end up sending a few people there at some point, I think, but it didn't really, nothing came of it, and it just sort of dissolved. There was a group of people who disagreed with the movement away from this scheme, the territorialist Zionists, and they decided territorialist Jews, rather, they're not about Zion anymore, and they decided we're going to try and get an area for Jews. But by 1917, about 100 years ago, the Balfour Declaration from the British government, which said we're going to establish a homeland for the Jews in Palestine, came out, and then basically this whole thing dissolved. What I want to think about a little bit now is also to look at this from a religious perspective. So religious Zionists, there were religious Zionists there at the Congress, and so you're a religious Zionist, and you have on the table these two options. On the one hand, Jews are dying. There's a concept in Judaism, pikuach nefesh, we want to save people's lives. And basically everything can be sacrificed to the end of pikuach nefesh. On the other hand, you have Israel, Eretz Yisrael, creating a homeland. This is a very important religious concept. So how do you vote as a religious Zionist in this context? What would be some of the parameters for voting as a religious Zionist? What do you think? How do you think the religious Zionists voted in this story? An emphatic no, okay. How come?
Well, because, you kind of do legitimize your claim if you go somewhere else.
Okay.
Israel's our land, and we have 2,000 years of history behind it. Why should we settle for less?
Okay. So the result really was a split, interestingly enough. The head of the Mizrahi, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Reines, voted for Herzl. He said he voted for the Uganda plan. What is some of the basis? It's not totally clear exactly what he thought, but what I have here in source number two is a letter from some member of the Mizrahi who wrote to the Mizrahi and said, I want to know what you guys think about. He wrote to the one in Lida, but I want to know what you think about the Uganda plan. Can you please tell me? And the response was, we can't really tell you because we haven't voted on it totally, but let me give you a few of my ideas and you can see from the response what they think. We have a great deal to respond to His Honor's words regarding the question of Uganda and the present settlement of the land of Israel. However, the council has forbidden this office to speak about this, either good or bad. Therefore, we are forced to pass over these matters in silence. However, there's no way. You can't ask a Jew a question like that. He's not going to answer. However, we will ask His Honor one thing. Can he please explain to us why he considers the notion that Uganda will be only a temporary means to achieving the land of Israel sophism? So this relates to the question, the point that we raised before. You know, people were arguing, this is sophistry. Nobody really expects us to go anywhere after we go to Uganda.
Sophism
means it's just like rhetoric. In other words, really, ideally, the plan is just to put everyone in Uganda, and that's going to be the end of Zionism. And people are saying, that's not true. We'll use it as a temporary means. We'll get somewhere else afterwards. So can you please explain how this is sophism? We think that a Jewish autonomous region would, with its political strength, its economic might, its cultural reality, its various relations with other countries and states, its influence over the Hebrew nation and its various institutions, be able to accomplish much in this matter. And not only do we believe this, but genius politicians like Chamberlain and Herzl have said similar things. We would be overjoyed if His Honor could prove the error of this perspective. So you see, I mean, they didn't answer the question, but they very much did answer the question. They felt, this is not true, we can use Uganda as a stepping stone to get to Israel. Having a country is really good, in general. And in addition, Rabbi Ryan has said he didn't want to split up the Zionist movement because he didn't want to create a vote in such a way that would break everything down. And you have to save Jews. The Jews are in trouble. That's the number one requirement. So that was one perspective in the religious Zionist world. The other perspective was from Rav Meir Bar Ilan and some of the other rabbis who were associated with the Chibat Tzion, which is a little bit more of the, I don't know, I won't call them Orthodox, but a little bit more of the classic yeshiva-oriented people that were involved in the Zionist movement, like the Netziv Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin from the yeshiva of Valazhin, and they said, absolutely not. We're not giving up Israel. Israel is Eretz Yisrael. This is the whole point. The whole point is to create a homeland in Eretz Yisrael. How can you possibly even think of creating a Jewish country anywhere else? That's absurd. We're voting against it. And it was an emphatic no. So this was the debate. So what I want to look at a little bit in the time that we have left is how do we square this in terms of religious beliefs? In other words, what actually is so special about Israel? This seemed to be part of the debate. You know, is there value to creating a Jewish autonomous country outside of Israel, or it's only in Israel, and if it's not in Israel, then forget it. We'll just stay in Europe, and there's no reason to go anywhere. So this is the debate that happened. We find that there is a little bit of background for this amongst our, you know, more traditional sources. Some of them are newer, some of them are older. So that's what I want to look at. So within the concept of Kedusha Taretz, we heard the term Kedusha Taretz, the land has holiness, it's holy. What exactly does that mean? What does Kedusha mean? Anyone? Ideas? Definition of Kedusha? It's one of those words where it translates to English as holiness, and then you say, that doesn't help me, because holiness doesn't mean anything either. It's like bracha. It's a blessing. Thanks. I don't know what a blessing is either. Yeah?
Something that's set aside.
Okay, so Kedusha usually has something to do with setting aside. You look at other uses of the verb kadosh in Hebrew, and you find that it means that it's separated. And that's probably the core of the meaning. It's separate, it's set aside, it's sanctified because it's been set aside for particular uses and not for other uses. The question is, who is the one that did that setting aside? Who sets it aside? So here you find that there's a split. The classic view, let's say, amongst many of the Rishonim, we'll see a little piece from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is that God set it aside. It's kadosh, the land is holy, because God said, this is the place. You want to have a relationship with me, you have to come to this place. This is the only, it's like a tool. You can only access a real relationship with God, become a full religious being, if you're in Israel. So we'll see that now a little bit in source number 3. This is the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. He's a very strong proponent of this view, and the Kuzari is structured as a discussion, at least in this part, between a rabbi and the king of the Khazars, who's trying to decide, by this point he's decided that he wants to be Jewish, he's trying to find out more about Judaism, so he's talking about this with the rabbi, and the rabbi says, even so, does the glory of God, which is only a ray of the divine light, benefit his people in his country? The real glory, the real way to access God is to be part of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. I don't want to talk about the Jewish people part now, we're going to talk about the land of Israel part. So the Khazar, the king of the Khazar says, I understand what thou meanest, it's a little bit of old English, by his people, but less intelligible is what thou sayest about his country. What do you mean by his country? What do you mean by having a country of God? So the rabbi says, thou wilt have no difficulty in perceiving that one country may have higher qualifications than others. There are places in which particular plants, metals, or animals are found, or where the inhabitants are distinguished by their form and character, since perfection or deficiency of the soul are produced by the mingling of the elements. Okay, so he says, you have no problem understanding, I mean, We may, but that you know, certain areas, certain places, certainly agriculturally, we can understand some place might be better to farm than others. If you live in a place where there's no water and everything is just rocks, it's very hard to farm there. If you live in the place where there is water and there's lush pastures and you have lots of fertile soil, then it's easy to farm there. And he says it's the same thing in terms of spirituality. There are certain places where it's easier or better, it's more possible to have a spiritual life, and certain places where it's harder to have a spiritual life. So he goes on to say, whosoever prophesied did so either in the Holy Land or concerning it. For example, Abraham, in order to reach it, Ezekiel and Daniel, on account of it, the two latter had lived during the time of the first temple and seen the Shekhinah, through the influence of which each one, who was duly prepared to become of the elect and able to prophesy, Adam lived and died in the land. Tradition tells us that the cave of Machpelah, where were buried the four pairs, Adam and Eve, Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah, this is the land which bore the name before the Lord, and of which it is stated, the eyes of the Lord, the God, are always upon it. It was appointed to guide the world and apportioned to the tribes of Israel from the time of the confusion of languages, as it is said, when the Most High divided amongst the nations their inheritance. Abram was not fit to gain the divine influence and to enter into a mutual compact until he had, in Palestine, made the covenant with him between the pieces. So the argument of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is that the land itself is in such a way that you cannot become a full spiritual being, you can't become a proper Jew, you can't have nevuah, you can't prophesize unless you're inside of Eretz Yisrael. It's a metaphysical claim. This land is more holy than anywhere else. So if you're going to make that claim, you really can't say, well, we're going to settle for a kind, I mean, there might be other practical concerns. We're not going to settle for anything else. This is Eretz Yisrael, and that's it. God set it aside. He is the one that made it Kadosh. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a very interesting and opposing view. It is a little bit more complicated than this, but I added some links for you if you want to look at it afterwards. But he has a more complicated view. And he quotes this statement of Yehuda Halevi, this position. It's echoed by others. The Ramban echoes this position. And he says that it's not true. He asks the question, a similar kind of question that the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi asks, which is, why is it that Avraham didn't have prophecy, didn't really enter into his brit that we read about in the parsha last week outside of Israel? Why could God not, in source 4, why could God not enter into an ultimate relationship with Avraham in Mesopotamia and had to guide him to a new land is an old problem. Judah Halevi, should say Halevi, in his Kuzari explains it with the uniqueness of the land of Israel as an ideal land from the meeting of God by man. He attributes metaphysical qualities to the land and endows it with a spiritual climate. Nachmanides, in his commentary to Leviticus, follows in Halevi's footsteps, as did the mystics. For them, the attribute of Kedusha, holiness, ascribed to the land of Israel, is an objective metaphysical quality inherent in the land. And he says, now he's going to disagree. With all my respect for the Rishonim, I must disagree with such an opinion. I do not believe that it is halachically cogent. Kedusha, under a halachic aspect, is man-made. More accurately, it is a historical category. A soil is sanctified by historical deeds performed by a sacred people, never by any primordial superiority. The halachic term kedusha ta'aretz, the sanctity of the land, denotes the consequence of a human act, either conquest or the mere presence of the people in that land. Kedusha is identical with man's association with Mother Earth. Nothing should be attributed a priori to dead matter. Objective kedusha smacks of fetishism. It's a pretty bad indictment of the from Rav Soloveitchik of previous opinions. But he says, and it's part of a more complex view, and that's why I added these links for if you want to read a little bit more about his overall view of this. But he says, at the core, kedusha ta'aretz, holiness of the land, was not created by God. It's created by people. When people decide, we're going to create a society here, we're going to give our lives to create the society here, everything's on the line to make this a certain kind of place, to make living here a certain kind of experience, that's what creates kedusha ta'aretz. Now, he doesn't disagree. He doesn't think you can create Israel in Uganda. But that's not what he's saying. And if you read elsewhere, it's clear. God said, I want you to live in Israel. But what creates the holiness is not that, you know, it's a magical place, which is already, you go there and then you have superpowered spirituality. What creates the holiness is people living there, wanting to live there, sacrificing to live there, creating the Kedusha. So if that's the case, there's at least a little possibility of saying that, you know, this something parallel to this can happen elsewhere. There's discussion about that. If Jewish people come to a place and they build a society, and we try and create a society based on Jewish values, based on, you know, halacha, based on trying to create a place of Kedusha, that's a possibility. We have it, you know, we're sitting in a place like that right now. A shul is called a mikdash mat, a small sanctuary. Why is that? What creates that? It's not because, you know, if you have a, like they have metal detectors, so you can have a Kedusha detector and someone's walking and said, oh, this is the right spot to build Shaar Shamayim because there's extra Kedusha here. It's because people made it into a place which is holy. That's the idea. So Rabbi Soloveitchik is presenting sort of in an opposing view. And that might be a basis for arguing that there's grounds to create a community outside of Israel. Yeah.
So how can he ignore all the places where it says
oh, so yeah, so this is part of where I'm trying to draw a subtle distinction, hopefully it's clear, that he's not arguing that we shouldn't go live in Israel. He's for sure God chose Israel as the land, right? That's clear, that's the point.
Yeah.
What he is arguing is that the way that that Kedusha is created, the reason why it works there is not because God made it in a certain way, but because people put their effort in and made it into a Kadosh place.
But don't we see, in fact, that it's a reciprocal cycle? Because God put it on the table that this is your place, and people go and make it holy, when they go there, they actually experience.
Right. So I hear what you're saying, and this is probably, as I was trying to work this out, this is probably one of the flaws in this line of reasoning. I mean, you can only push this so far. Yeah.
So, for instance, Israel, the land of Israel, after the destruction of the Second Temple, laid fallow for 2,000 years. Many conquerors came there. They tried to build. They tried to grow. Nothing grew until now, and we came back to the land. So how do you explain that? It means that we are supposed to be there and build that land that belongs to us. And it was given to us by Hashem.
Okay. You're right. And I think this argument can only go so far. Basically, what he's trying to say, again, I can't totally defend it, I guess. There are holes in this argument. Is that, again, when that success happens and when that Kedusha, when that holiness emerges, it's not based on the fact that God just put it into the soil of the land. It's based on people returning and working the land. There are limitations. Let's just take one more minute because I want to wrap up. We're basically out of time. The last two sources here, we're not going to have time to look at them inside, but I wanted to explain, maybe I can briefly explain it, that there are different sets of rules in terms of halachot that apply to Eretz Yisrael. There's different kinds of rules of halacha, areas of halacha, which specifically apply to the land. One of the examples here is trumot and maasrot. If you grow produce in the land, you have to separate things out and give them to the kohen, give them to different people. That's one rule. There are other rules of things, examples of things which only apply in the land. One example is smicha, the classical smicha that happened in the times of the Tanaim and earlier, where you could appoint someone as a member of the Sanhedrin, the upper rabbinical court. That also is something that had to happen inside the land. But we find that in 5 and 6 that the different descriptions of the size of the land, the area which is encompassed, what's called Israel in terms of separating Trumot and Maasrot, and what's called Israel in terms of appointing judges are not the same. We can't discuss the historical import of it now, so hopefully this will be clear. There's a difference in terms of the size. You can look inside to see. And what Reb Chaim Soloveitchik explained, and Rav Soloveitchik also explained this point, is that there are different ranges of definition of what's called Israel. Some things are based on the inherent holiness inside of the land. We conquered the land, it created inherent holiness, and therefore when stuff grows out of it, you have to separate Trumot and Maasrot. That's part of the reality. But there's also something called Shem Yisrael. We try to settle the land, create a society in the land. And as far as that society reaches, as far as there are Jews who are identifying with a state of Jews, then there the other halacha, creating a court, is a great example, apply to that broader categorization. in areas where Jews are trying to settle, Jews are trying to make it their land. So regardless of how you view the Uganda plan is over, right? Now we have the real thing. But in terms of looking at Eretz Yisrael today, there's a very, very important lesson there. There is this notion that Rabbi Yehuda Levi mentions of inherent holiness of the land. That's a real thing. But there's also a concept of trying to create a society, what Rabbi Soloveitchik mentions, trying to settle the land in a certain way, make it a place that has Jewish values. That's also a very important part of Zionism from a religious perspective, from a basic halakhic perspective, of trying to create a country that is a place for us to live in, is a place which reflects our ideas of a way of life. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very good.
We have a 5-minute break.